couples who have shared this privilege know what a liberating power it is. They know that fruitfulness crowns the mystery of love, that it alone can give to marriage all of its moral, human and religious significance. It draws them inwards and upwards, closer to one another and closer to God. But this power of giving life is also a problem. No Christian worthy of the name denies the sacredness and the nobility of a new life. He is ready to welcome children into his home. But how many? On this point hang immense difficulties. They are difficulties that most young parents are experiencing today. For some it is a source of excruciating doubt and torment, for others it brings about a weakening of faith and loss of interior peace. It is a complex problem that must be squarely faced. Three virtues must guide us in an analysis of this problem. The degree to which married couples possess them will determine their success in coping with the responsibilities and ambiguities of rearing a family in modern society. The first of these is the virtue of abandon. The question of a family is not a matter of mathematics. It is a matter of virtue. Large families, in the final analysis, are based upon the virtue of abandon or hope. Indeed, it is foolhardy to bring children into the world without this trust in Providence. Married couples who understand the far-reaching implications of this virtue, understand at the same time that they are committed to a life of sacrifice and generosity. They have taken Christ at His word and thrown themselves upon His abundance. They believe that God will not embarrass them. They realize that the number of children they have depends solely upon the strength of their love. But this does not solve the problem. Another virtue is necessary. That of prudence. The modern world's conspiracy against families is little short of the diabolic. There is a question of lodging, for example. Apartment dwellers here encounter a real obstacle to a large family. Or the question of finances. A husband frequently finds it humanly impossible to support many children on his salary. There is also a question of health. Many women cannot stand the physical strain of repeated pregnancy. In such cases, prudence demands that couples space their children. Where another child would constitute a real threat to the harmony of the home, prudence must intervene. And Christian prudence will indicate one of two things, either absolute or periodic continence. This is a difficult alternative and may well throw parents into a state of revolt. But it is well to remember, as R. Bonds writes in this article, that fruitfulness is not only of the body. A father and mother are never through giving life to their children. If they must renounce calling new souls into existence, they are freer to give more attention to those they already have. This task of the education of their children is one that is noble enough and complex enough to occupy them totally. It assumes a union between them just as precious as physical union, of which it is, after all, the consequence. A final virtue is necessary for a complete solution of this problem, the virtue of heroism. The problem under discussion is an acute and painful one. There is no easy way out. Parents are ultimately driven to heroism, either the heroism of accepting a large family, or the heroism of justly limiting their family. The only other solution is a calculating egoism that cheats both the natural law and God. It is this virtue of heroism that adds the final dimension to the mystery of love. All love is heroic. Those who do not accept the Christian code of morality will see no problem here. It is pointless to argue with them, still more pointless to envy them their ease and comfort. A Christian who abdicates before the demands of heroism is not even worthy of the ersatz happiness of those who refuse heroism. Because of the conditions in society which conflict with the ideals of Christian marriage, young couples must be thoroughly prepared for the state they are about to embrace. A comprehensive program of instruction before marriage is one of the best means of avoiding problems after marriage. Questions. Does this chapter suggest that the golden mean of not too much and not too little is to be applied in deciding the number of children in a family? 2. State in your own words the privilege and the problem of fruitfulness in marriage. 3. Why does the problem not exist for those who do not accept the Christian code? 4. Has any effort been made by theologians to determine just how many children are required of a couple to fulfill their share in perpetuating the human race? 5. Is sympathy always for the mother, rather than the father, in a large family? Is this justified? 6. How do the virtues of A. abandon, B. prudence, and C. heroism contribute to a solution of the problem? Discuss. I. Each home is an island that must answer for itself. 2. Divine prodigality follows upon human generosity. 3. If a father of 12 is privileged, it is above all because he has met a valiant woman. 4. Once a certain degree of spirituality has been attained, then there is place for continence. 5. There is heroism in a justified refusal to go beyond an average family. Chapter V. The Flesh and the Spirit. Synopsis. Some currents of Christian tradition would seem to deny the body its rightful role in marriage. But the totality of Christian life teaches rather the contrary. It affirms that the flesh must also be redeemed. The Christian teaching concerning the body takes into account three facts. The first is the fact that man is body and soul. There can be no real opposition between the two. The second is the fact of sin. This reality can set up a conflict and disharmony that may take some time for the individual to overcome and which may create a false sense of values in some marriages. But a third fact must enter into consideration, that of redemption. The graces of redemption have an uplifting and ennobling effect upon the body. Saint Paul stated the high dignity of the body when he said that it becomes, through grace, the temple of the Holy Ghost. Thus Christianity profoundly respects the nature and laws of creation. It cautions us at once against the dangers of inordinate demands of the flesh and also against any form of evangelism that would tend to relegate the body to a level of insignificance in the hierarchy of human values. It affirms that the flesh is not sinful, but it can be made an instrument of sin. Everything depends upon the meaning we wish to accord it. With these clarifications in mind, we can understand the qualities which the conjugal act should show forth. Rightly used, this act can become highly meritorious. Saint Thomas affirms that the act of marriage is honorable, that it is moral, and that it is in itself, in its intrinsic finality, that it finds this honor and this morality. Saint Augustine taught the same thing. Pope Innocent XI confirm these doctrinal affirmations. The conjugal act is not an animal but always a human act. It must therefore be a spiritual and free act. That is, sex is not merely an outlet for the caprices of instinct, but the soul must express itself through the body. If there be no spiritual communication between the persons, what should be a human act is frighteningly vitiated. Such an exercise of liberty demands education. Constant vigilance must be maintained to prevent this act from defeating its purpose. Patience is also necessary, because it may be some time before perfect harmony is achieved in this act. Attentive respect and a certain self-forgetting are also necessary to offset the danger of egoism or precipitation which stand as obstacles to marital happiness. 2. An act of love. More than freedom or patience, this act is a work of love. Without love it cannot be the magnificent gesture of intimacy and fruitfulness willed by the Creator. As an expression of love, the conjugal act becomes a hymn of praise to God. The redemptive graces of Christ are here indispensable. For the graces of the sacrament of marriage increase love by healing its wounded nature and by deepening its quality with all the resources of divine charity. 3. A meritorious act. This follows from what has been said. The conjugal act is charged with tremendous spiritual significance when it is accomplished in conjunction with the order of grace. It cannot be stressed too much that this quality is achieved only with effort. Only gradually, and under the purifying effects of the sacraments and the graces of a Christian way of life, will this evangelization of the flesh be finally completed? When we understand the proper use of the conjugal act, we are in a better position to understand the role of continence. Before this problem, there are three possible attitudes we can adopt. First, the laws of conjugal chastity can be ignored. Second, continence can be accepted in a slavish, grudging manner. And thirdly, the true value of continence can be grasped in the broader perspective of what Christian doctrine teaches about marriage. Continence in marriage, like the conjugal act itself, must serve the ends of love. J. Madore points out that when parents accept continence generously, in the spirit of the cross, it can be offered for the salvation of the children God has already confided to their care. By thus disciplining their bodies, parents participate in the redemptive work of Christ as well as enhance their own love. Continence also serves the ends of love by acting as a check against the routine that a constant use of marriage rites tends to produce. Married couples normally express their love through the use of their bodies. But abstinence from this use permits them to find other, and sometimes deeper, means of expression. Questions. I. What are some facts to be taken into consideration in the Catholic view of sex? 2. What two extremes must be avoided? 3. How can use of sex be a source of grace? 4. Under what conditions may married couples resolve to practice perpetual continence? 5. What are three possible attitudes toward birth control? 6. How does continence in marriage profit the children? The parents? 7. What can be done to prepare young couples for continence? Discuss. I. Christianity does not give the flesh its rightful place, but suppresses it. 2. Do you not know that your body is for the Lord and the Lord for the body? 3. Everything depends on the sense that man consents to give to the flesh. 4. The conjugal act must always be a human act. Part E. This is a great mystery. Chapter VII. The Sacrament of Marriage Synopsis. What is the relation between human love and divine love? This question leads us to the proper sacramental nature of marriage. The answer to it can be developed under three headings. Marriage is a grace of Christ, it is an offering to Christ, and, finally, it is a mystery. I. Marriage as a grace indicates the active part Christ plays in marriage. Grace must here be understood in the deep sense as an action of Christ. That is to say, through the sacrament, Christ operates in marriage. He is present in every marriage. He draws two people close to one another. He seals their union. He shares in the joy and suffering of marriage as much as the spouses themselves. The graces Christ brings to marriage take three principal forms. He brings first of all graces of purification. He purifies human love. He subjects the excessive demands of the flesh and erases the marks of egoism that all human love bears. Through this grace, something of the dignity of Christ's glorified body is conferred upon the bodies of married couples. Synopses and discussion questions lodge. This grace is the germ of a second grace, that of transfiguration. Marriage is not evocation of comfort and ease. Christian couples are constantly called upon to transcend themselves through renunciation and sacrifice. Every marriage must mirror the period of time between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. This is the law of Christian life, it is the law of Christian marriage. The mystery of Christ therefore is not really distinct from the mystery of the Christ who operates at the heart of marriage, transfiguring it with his grace. A third grace is that of fertility. This means more than Christ's invitation to couples to have children. Through the grace of fertility, the very meaning of the child is changed. This grace gives to marriage the mission of giving children to God.